would you take for your soul? $1 million?
You'll want to be sure to catch the rest of Pastor Terry's message in just a moment. But first, we want to thank you for tuning in to the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast with pastor and author Terry Bailey. This broadcast is also produced as a free podcast, which you can find on iTunes or become a subscriber through our website. We'll have more information at the end of the broadcast, but for right now, let's join Pastor Terry as he preaches this insightful message.
We often find lessons in the lives of circumstances of particular individuals. I said in the 8 o'clock service, and I felt this keenly as I worked on this sermon this week, I'm not sure what I'm going to do is a good idea for a sermon. The people in the 8 o'clock service told me it was okay. So we'll see how that goes. But I keenly remember the conflicted feelings that rose in me 40-some years ago when, as an undergraduate at Milligan College, I first really learned anything about the life of Michelangelo. And just to be sure we're all on the same page, I mean the Renaissance artist and not the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, who I don't think was around when I was in college. But just to be clear on that, and I'm going to try to convey something of it this morning. Michelangelo was born in 1475, his father was a merchant. His mother had poor health and passed away when Michelangelo was only 6 years old. His nanny was the wife of a stonecutter in the Italian town of Florence. His father's business was failing, and the father put Michelangelo in a special school where he would learn lots of things, primarily languages, lots of languages that he thought would help put the family business back on its feet. But at 13 years of age, Michelangelo decided he would rather study art. And his father pitched a horrible fit. Artists were tradesmen doomed to lives of manual labor, and very few, only the best, only a few of the best were ever selected by wealthy patrons so as to avoid becoming starving artists. But Michelangelo was stubborn. And the heart of his commitment was a deeply felt calling to celebrate the majesty and the glory of the work of God, which he thought was the whole purpose of art. He apprenticed himself first to a painter and then to a sculptor, and his talent became so obvious that at 16 years of age, he drew the attention of the humanist-minded Italian royal court. And it looked like, despite his father's thoughts, at 16 he was about to arrive and do that whole rich and famous thing. But Michelangelo did not want to work for the royalty of the Italian court. Their religion was a hybrid of the science of the day and the politics of the moment, and the art that they wanted sang the praises of man rather than God. So at 16, instead of becoming rich and famous, it looked as though Michelangelo was about to completely do himself out of success in his chosen field. He went to Rome, figuring that there, in the religious center of Christianity, he would find like-minded people. And he began work there in 1498, at 23 years of age, he sculpted the Pietà for St. Peter's Basilica. That's on the left, Mary cradling Jesus, taken down from the cross. And in 1505, David for the main entrance of the Palazzo Vecchio. We show David from the waist up only, because David is a nude sculpture, and all of Michelangelo's nudes are anatomically correct. If you want to see the whole picture, it's not that hard to find. These words attracted the attention of Pope Julius II, who wanted Michelangelo to create for him a tomb, he said, of unparalleled power and grandeur. And Michelangelo accepted the job, which would take up several years, thinking he had finally gotten where he wanted to be. But soon he was in nonstop wrangling confrontation with the Pope and all his representatives, because Michelangelo wanted to carve a tomb that would sing the glories of God. And Pope Julius wanted a tomb that would sing the glories of Pope Julius. And it was really hard to get out of a contract with the Pope in the early 16th century. But after a year of quarrying and transporting marble, the contract was canceled for budgetary reasons. And Julius immediately decided that Michelangelo should do something that would cost less, to paint the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Michelangelo protested that he was not really a painter. Too bad. We need you to do it. Again, running arguments about the theme, and with the work about half done, not that work, the one that he started trying to satisfy the Pope. With that work approaching half done, he got so mad that he fired all the assistants the Pope had given him and whitewashed everything that had been done so far and started over, refusing to listen to anyone, and was so stubborn that they finally decided he should be allowed to follow his sacred work for the vision. You see the result. He finished the Sistine Chapel ceiling in 1512, and 4 months later, Pope Julius II died, and the Pope's heirs decided that they needed to put Michelangelo back to work on that tomb at a greatly reduced budget. Many more fights about the subject matter. In the end, Michelangelo gave them this, with Moses as the centerpiece, and they decided to keep it. The new Pope, Leo X, had actually been a boyhood enemy of Michelangelo's and still did not like the man, but talent was talent. So Michelangelo was commissioned to sculpt a new facade for the Church of San Lorenzo. Now you see there the church as it is still, because Michelangelo never got to finish the project after 3 conflict filled years. That was canceled at Leo's death. But you see the church as it is, and a Photoshop of how it would look if Michelangelo's designs had been carried out. The next pope, Clement VII, put Michelangelo back into the tomb-making business. That also got canceled due to a near civil war and the sack of Rome. Clement did without his tomb, though he would need it shortly. In the meantime, he commissioned Michelangelo to do another less expensive painting job back on the altar wall of the Sistine Chapel. At least these two, the Pope and Michelangelo, agreed about the subject matter. It would be the resurrection, not the specific resurrection of Jesus Christ, but the grand, glorious, final resurrection of all the saints. And the work was started when Clement VII died. This is a problem when you start as an artist as a young man, because popes are all old men. Paul III decided the church needed something more in the nature of a stern lecture and changed the theme to the Last Judgment rather than the resurrection. Michelangelo was ticked, but he did it. And he painted the Last Judgment with such fury and savagery and misery and nudity, not the kind of nudity that celebrated the human figure like in David, but nudity which stressed the shame being imposed on these people who were being committed to the horrible, final, terrible day of the Lord. And some people observed that some of the people being consigned to judgment in the painting looked incredibly like church leaders of the day. When they viewed the finished work, Paul III declared Michelangelo a heretic and banned him from doing anything else. But popes come and go. Paul III died. Julius III came. And the painting remained, though in 1564, just after Michelangelo died. I'll come to that in a minute. In 1564, the Council of Trent voted to have clothing painted over the worst of the nudity on the altar wall. Take it for what it's worth. Michelangelo never earned much money at the business, and what little he did earn in his years, he sent mostly home to his father until his father died as a kind of atonement for his long-ago refusal to step in and save the family business. In one surviving letter, Michelangelo says to his family, "I will send you what you require if I have to sell myself into slavery." And as an old man, he took on one last project, which he almost finished: the renovation of St. Peter's Basilica. And he had to fight the same fights as always to keep the project about God. In his 70s, in failing health, worn by long struggles, he wrote in another letter that he really wanted to quit and go home, but he said, "If I left Rome, I would feel guilty dooming St. Peter's to failure and allowing it to become a monument to man's vanity, and that would be a great shame and a deadly sin." He died in 1564, laid down his sculptures one evening, or chisels one evening, went to bed and could not get up in the morning, leaving the last two proposed sculptures unfinished, and spent 6 days in excruciating pain, meditating on death, and praying for redemption. As I say, 40-plus years after first learning it, I remain somewhat conflicted about the life of Michelangelo. So, Jesus said, "If you want to follow me, you must deny yourself and take up your cross. Try to save your life, and you will lose it. Lose it for my sake and the gospel's, and it will be saved. And what would you take for your soul anyway? The whole world? Would that be a fair trade? Whole world for your soul? And what would you give for your soul if there was something you could give for it? Because see, there's me, and there's the world. And there's the day that I will come in the glory of the Father with all the angels of heaven trailing in my wake. And before that day, you have to choose me or the world." So much to be said about this, and I hope that I have chosen wisely by taking time on Michelangelo, but let me start with this. Three words in the Greek of the New Testament that get translated as life. First, there is zoe, which refers to the mechanical aspect, the beating heart, the pumping lungs, all that kind of thing. We take from it our word zoology. And then there is bios, from which we take our word biology, which refers to the animating force, something unseen, something beyond circulating blood and sparking nerve endings, some spiritual force that makes the clay of our body live. And then there's psuche. And the idea of psuche is that you take the zoe, the physical body, and you take the bios, the spiritual animating force, and you put them together and you get what the Bible calls a soul. Psuche. Sometimes it is translated soul, sometimes it is translated life. Even in this passage, the translation is non-uniform in most of the versions you will be reading. Psuche is the word used throughout everything that Russ read for us, but in verse 35 it's generally translated life, and in verse 36 it's generally translated soul. I do not take it upon myself to criticize the translators, only to make you aware of what actually is being said here, and to tell you this has always been the biblical view. though the Hebrew words are different, the concepts are the same. God made for Adam a body of clay, the Zoe, and he breathed into it the breath of life, the Bios, and Adam became a living soul, a suke. The life Jesus references in this passage then is not just physical life, but the entirety of who we are, our souls. Moving on from that, Jesus asks essentially two different questions. Some will say he only asks one question and he asked it two different ways. I have come to firmly believe that he's asking two completely different questions. You may draw your own conclusions. First question, what would you take for your soul? $1 million? $100 million? $1 billion? What if someone should offer you the whole world for your soul? Would you take that deal? I'm going to tell you that for us the question is largely academic because we already made the deal and fact is we sold cheap. George MacDonald, Scottish Christian scholar and apologist of a couple centuries back, told the story of a cloth merchant selling cloth by the yard who cheated every customer he ever had by the width of his thumb. Measure the cloth out, put your thumb down to the short side of the line, cut there, so that you charge for the full thing, but you keep one thumb's width of the fabric each and every sale. On the one hand, that doesn't sound like a lot. A thumb's width, it depends though, because if it's my thumb or it's Mark's thumb, it would be different. But you keep a thumb's width of what you sold for yourself, increasing your stock and ultimately your money. MacDonald's conclusion was this: one thumb's width at a time, this man cut from his soul and put in his purse. What would you take for your soul? Ask the victims of the current opiate epidemic. Ask the people who provide the drugs to fuel the current opiate epidemic. What would you take for your soul? Ask the human traffickers who peddle the flesh of their fellow man. What would you take for your soul? Ask those who have achieved official office and put justice up for sale. What would you take for your soul? Jesus asks the question, but he asks it of men who have long ago made the sale. The whole reason he needed to come is that we have sold our souls to the devil. And the devil made the pitch to Jesus for what it's worth. You remember that scene there in the wilderness following the baptism of Jesus? Satan says, see, Jesus, all the kingdoms of the world spread out before you. Bow down and worship me, and I will give it all to you. Jesus rejected the very offer he mentions. Let us just say that Satan made each of us a somewhat lowball proposition and still managed to ring up the sale. Second question, and I do continue to consider this a separate question. If you read the parallel in the gospel according to Matthew, I think the distinction is clearer. For what will it profit a man if he gained the whole world and forfeits his life / soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his life / soul? In the eventuality that you foolishly sold your soul, what would you give to get it back? Taken this way, verse 38 makes a lot more sense to me. What would you give to get it back. I have already indicated that the whole world would not be a fair price for a soul, and Satan is a better trader than I am, and I don't have the whole world at my disposal anyway, so I'm kind of sunk, I guess. Unless there is someone who has something, something of ultimate value, that might even be able to redeem my bartered soul and is willing to give that something. And so Jesus says, there is me and there is the world. And the world has lost one sinful and adulterous generation chasing the heels of another. But I, Jesus said, I can pay the price. I will pay the price. This is what we've been talking about, guys, he says to his apostles. This is what's going to happen when we get to Jerusalem. I will pay the price. But you have to choose. Totally without claiming that Michelangelo lacked character flaws, which he did not. And totally without justifying the unfair way that the artist was treated by the religious leadership of the day, which remains sad and unfair. It seems to me that Michelangelo could have led a very comfortable life, the darling artist of the Italian royal court, if only he was willing to give up making his art about God. And he could have made out a lot better with the popes than he did if only he had been willing to give up making his art about God. The trade, that very trade, was proffered. But what would you take for your soul? And if you once bartered it away, what could you give to get it back afterwards? Better, of course, not to barter it off in the first place, only it's too late. We've already done it, and we totally lack the means to redeem it. But Jesus has the means and spent the means. And there is a day when He will return in the glory of the Father with all the angels of heaven in His wake. And before that day, we have a choice to make. Deny ourselves. Take up our cross and follow Him. Leave your souls right where they are. Oh, the paltry thumb's widths of linen for which we have sold ourselves. But we can be redeemed.
We want to take a moment to thank all of you, our listeners, for setting aside time each week for the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast on this station. You can find out more about the church with a quick visit to our website at www.christforeastcanton.com. On behalf of Pastor Terry and all the folks at Indian Run Christian Church, I pray God's blessing on you and your family.